This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. I'm Rico Galliano, in for Steve Chiatakis. Today, we're at Notre Dame Academy, an all-girls high school in the Palms area of West LA.
Yeah.
Students just finished class for the day. Now they have after-school sports and homework and maybe a job to navigate next. And as seniors, they also have college applications on their minds. The University of California deadline was Thanksgiving weekend. Many private college apps are due in early January. With those deadlines comes,
I would say, a lot of pressure.
High school senior Natalia Kolosniko and her classmates Madeline Smith and Gemma Clark can tell you all about it.
Mainly from self-pressure and pressure from my school.
I actually lost my period from, you know, stress. And, you know, lots of long talks with my mom and dad and just trying to, you know, maintain college essays and schoolwork. But it's manageable.
And then there's also, I couldn't really sleep, just like restless, eating a lot, stress eating.
If you applied to college, you maybe also felt some pressure to get in, but probably not like these kids do. Anxiety and depression are on the rise for teenagers. According to a recent Pew survey, 61% of teens say they feel pressure to get good grades. And that's mostly because so many of them aspire to attend a four-year college. That's a problem, because while the number of spots available at elite colleges has been stable over the past few decades, the number of students applying to snag one of those spots has gone up. So college prospects feel mounting demand to stand out from their peers by racking up impressive extracurriculars or taking four advanced placement classes at a time. Some even worry a 4.0 GPA isn't enough. For students whose parents can't help them navigate the process or who wonder how on earth their families would pay for it, it can be overwhelming. In Los Feliz, Marshall High is an LAUSD public school. It's pretty big. It's got around 2,300 students.
Many of the students on the first day of 12th grade, their stress level has been primed all summer long. Some have already been working on their college essays. Some have been doing SAT test prep. Some have done nothing. But many students start that first day with their stress level already higher than it should be.
That's Mark Roeder, a teacher at John Marshall. So here at this high school, a group of students founded a wellness center run by the students and for the students. The idea is to educate one another about mental health and to help each other cope. Senior student Aaron Jair Gonzalez helped start the center.
I used to have a friend who she used to be really, really happy. And then when she went to high school, she kind of just like became super down and sad all the time. And it was really tough seeing her like that. And she started going to therapy and she started getting help. And I wanted to do that with two other people too. So I felt like the Wellness Center was the best thing for me.
Senior John Dios is part of the Wellness Center and offers friends simple advice when they're stressed out.
The best advice I can give them is to like take it slow. Like, you know, you don't have to rush yourself. You don't have to like worry right now. Just like be organized and like stay calm about the whole situation.
And if that doesn't work, Notre Dame Academy senior Angela Garcia says there's always screen time.
When I'm overly stressed, I just watch TV to try to calm myself down or like watch YouTube videos. Yeah, I just like take my mind off of it for a while and then go back to it when I'm not as like crazy.
For a deeper look at the diversity of experiences for LA's college hopeful seniors, KCET's SoCal Connected just produced an episode about it called Under Pressure. That premieres tonight. The filmmakers spent time with students from both private and public high schools here in California and with the high school guidance counselors who help students cope with the increasingly bewildering logistics and emotions of applying to college. Gina Pollack is the producer and she joins me now. Hi, Gina.
Hi.
So we're going to get into the episode shortly, but first, we just heard from some high school seniors at John Marshall High, which is your alma mater, I understand. You
yes.
are a class of what?
2005. Go Barristers.
Do you remember, though, this level of worry about college back then?
You know, I think that college applications were always a stressful time, but it seems to me that it's gotten a lot more extreme since I was in high school. I remember thinking, obviously, that a 4.0 was a really good GPA. And like, if you had a 4.0, you're pretty much set. You had a pretty decent SAT score. You're good to go. But a lot of the kids that I spoke to for this documentary were so stressed out about having a 4.0 because they felt like it wasn't high enough.
Is that justified, though? Like, how won't they get in somewhere with grades like those?
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of almost catch 22 about this. There is definitely a school that everyone can get into. There are 4,000 colleges in America. I think part of the problem is that people are really just focused on maybe the top 50, according to U.S. News and World Reports, and they feel like if they don't get into those top schools, they're kind of failures and they'll never get a job and everything is over for them, which is obviously not true. But I think that there's this kind of renewed obsession with the name of the school.
And there are examples of this in the episode, yes?
Yeah. So we talked to some kids and some college counselors about this, and we have a bite.
I know some parents who, you know, literally like want their kids to go into Harvard so they can tell their friends that their kid got into Harvard.
I'm just telling you, I went to Cal State Fullerton. I've had parents straight tell me in my office that their kid will never go to a Cal State. And I'm like, well, that's, and I show them my degree and it doesn't faze them. It's a disdain.
So where did this come from? Why is there so much more emphasis on getting into those elite schools as opposed to, you know, any of the 4,000 you just mentioned?
Well, I think it's kind of a innately American thing in a way to want the best. I think a lot of people believe that the name of your school really defines you and where you go is going to kind of set up your entire life. I think that that's definitely a myth, but it's something that's very ingrained in us. It's something that's ingrained in us since we're really young. I talked to some kids who said that, you know, since their first day of preschool, the preschool teacher said, this is the first day of your education that will end in a college degree.
I'm assuming this was a private preschool.
I think it was a private preschool. This was a girl that I spoke to at Beckman High School in Irvine, and she remembers that from preschool. So I think, you know, there's also some preschools in the LA area that are offering STEM courses.
What?
Yeah. And, you know, so I think that there's this real obsession with where are you going to go? What is the name of the school? And I don't think there's one specific place where that's come from, but it's really kind of gotten out of hand to the point where people are getting really, really stressed out.
I think a big eye opener for me, and I think a lot of viewers are going to be seeing this episode and seeing the behind the scenes look at the industry that's sort of been built up around college admissions.
Yeah.
At one point, your cameras take us to NACAC, which stands for?
It's the National Association for College Admissions Counseling.
Tell us a little more about that conference and what goes on there.
Yeah. So one of the things that we did for this documentary is speak to a lot of high school counselors who deal with college admissions, and all of them were telling me they were going to NACAC. And I was like, what on earth is that? And it's basically this convention that takes place every single year in a different state, a different city. This time it was in Louisville, Kentucky. And basically college admissions officers from different universities all over the country come there to network with high school counselors.
Do you have, I mean, are public school counselors also going to these events?
Yes. So public school counselors are going, but definitely less of them are able to go financially. And one of the counselors that I spoke to, Linda McGee, talked about that with us in the documentary.
NACAC is where you really see the disparities and they just hit you in the face. I mean, this is where you see the haves and the have-nots.
Flights, lodging, tickets, the costs add up. And most private schools foot the bill.
I need to know those colleges really, really well. And I need to know those admissions people really, really well. And they need to know us.
That last voice we heard was a private school counselor. So the private school folks go all expenses paid. What do the public school counselors do?
So the public school counselors have to pay for everything themselves. Linda McGee, who is the college counselor at Downtown Magnets here in L.A., actually started a GoFundMe so that she could raise money to go to the conference. She knows how important it is. She will meet all of these people from the colleges. She will be able to say, I have a student who's really interested in biology and they want to go to your school. What should they do to apply? It's really important When the applications come in, I mean, you can imagine these admissions people get so many applications. If they know, oh, this came from the web schools, we know Hector Martinez, he's the counselor there, he's told us about some of these students, we might take a closer look at those applications. When you have a public school counselor who has 500 students, you know, they're already overwhelmed and they might not have the resources or the time to even go to NACAC.
So that's one obvious way that some students are seem disadvantaged terribly in this system. What are some others?
So I think one of the big disadvantages for students who don't maybe have extremely wealthy parents or have extra income is the private counselors. So this is something we all remember from the college scandal. Rick Singer was one of them. Yes. But there's this whole industry now of, they're called independent educational consultants. And they are, you know, they do any variety of things. Some of them will take you through the entire application process. So they'll say, let's sit down, tell me what kind of schools you're interested in, what do you want to do? And they'll help you figure out where to apply. They'll help you figure out your essay. They'll help you maybe refer you to an SAT tutor that works with them. They have alumni that they've worked with at all of these schools, so they can really help. But these counselors cost a lot of money.
So clearly these are some ways where it seems like wealthy kids are advantaged in this system. And yet there's a quote in your film where somebody says, this is the stress of getting into college is the great equalizer. This affects kids of all strata of society, all class and all levels of wealth. How is it affecting people of wealth?
So I think a lot of kids from backgrounds that, you know, their parents went to college, they go to these really rigorous high schools where there's just so much pressure. A lot of them feel like they don't have this amazing experience that sets them apart from everyone else. They haven't struggled maybe in the way that someone else has. They haven't gone through a war. They haven't cured cancer. There's just such a high expectation for what I think students think they need to do to get into college. Mm-hmm. And then low-income kids are like, well, I didn't do a service trip to China because I couldn't afford it. Mm-hmm. I didn't cure cancer because I didn't have some special biology program.
Or perhaps my father wasn't, you know, like the head of surgery at some major medical institution.
Right. And an interesting thing we found is that students in really rigorous academic high schools, so these kind of college preparatory high schools, are actually experiencing severely high rates of anxiety and depression, and they've actually been designated an at-risk group. And, you know, another thing that we looked at is this list that USC has, which is this VIP list of all the kids that have a connection. So this was a list that was sent around with the dean of admissions and some of the old coaches. Mm-hmm. And there's blacked out names, but next to it you can see, you know, recommended for admission, twins, possible donors, and like the amount of money that those people could donate. So $2 million, $3 million, $10 million, like we'll donate to men's golf team in Thailand. It really shows you that inequality, and it's
kind of baked into the yeah. system. It's an institutional issue.
Yeah. And I feel like college admissions is one of those areas where inequality is just stronger than maybe anywhere else, because it's a place that you're saying, listen, you can work really hard, but if you have a parent who went to this school, if you have a private tutor, if you have $1 million to donate, you can just jump to the front of the line. And all you other kids, you have to kind of wait in the back.
All right. Clearly, this all just feels like an untenable situation for both the kids and the parents. So what do we do about it? What are some solutions being floated?
So one of the solutions that people are talking about a lot is that the University of California is actually thinking about eliminating the SAT and ACT as a testing requirement.
News about that today is a lawsuit.
Yes. So there's a lawsuit from the public counsel against University of California saying that the test discriminates and it's actually unconstitutional because multiple studies show that the score that you receive on the test is directly correlated to how wealthy your family is.
Yes.
And that, you know, really also goes back to that testing and tutoring that a lot of wealthy kids can afford. If you take the test 30 times in a boot camp, you're going to get a better score.
Do you think that'll actually help? Would that actually relieve stress, do you think, for a lot of these kids?
I think it would help. I think that a lot of kids are spending so much time studying for the SAT and the ACT. It's just one other thing that they're doing that's causing them to burn out. And actually, University of Chicago did this already. They made it test optional, and they said that they got a lot more applications in general, and they got a lot more applications from low-income students and students of color.
We'll see what happens. Gina Pollack is the producer for KCET's SoCal Connected episode, Under Pressure, it's called. How can people watch this?
It premieres tonight on KCET, which is Channel 28, and you can watch it online at kcet.org.
It's important stuff, Gina. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Next up, another idea that could potentially help even out the differences between the haves and the have-nots, a proposal to get money out of the LA City political campaign system. You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Rico Galliano, sitting in for Steve Giotakis. Three LA City Council members are calling for local elections to be fully financed with taxpayer money. Mike Bonin, Paul Koretz, and David Rue say they want a, quote, clean money system to combat the influence of cash in the political system. David Zonizer is covering the story for the LA Times, and he joins me now. Hi, David.
Hello.
So before we get into the public financing issue, last week, the council actually passed a measure that's somewhat related, and that measure apparently forbids real estate developers from contributing to political campaigns if they have projects pending before the city. How significant is that? Are developers a big enough source of cash for local politicians running for office for this to matter?
So in LA, one of the most powerful things the city council touches is real estate and real estate development. Council members have the power to allow a developer to build 30 stories on a piece of property where the rules allow only six. Mm-hmm. Or council members have allowed a developer to build 200 units where the zoning allows only 100. Those types of increases make developers money, and so developers would be foolish not to support the candidates they think are going to take those kind of decisions. Now, the downside is that's created a lot of cynicism, at minimum, about how decisions are made at City Hall. So last week, the council did unanimously vote to prohibit real estate developers and their top executives from making donations starting in March 2022.
So there's been a fair amount of criticism of that measure, though, including by your paper, the LA Times. There's an editorial that called it, quote, a job half finished. Why is that?
Well, because it touches only a part of the issue, right? So real estate developers would be prohibited from giving, but they would not be prohibited from raising money, which they do quite a bit of, right? Mm-hmm. And it also didn't get at the issue of, let's say, limited liability companies, which are companies where it's really hard to tell who the owner is, right? And mm-hmm. so there are a lot of real estate developers that give through what they call LLCs, mm-hmm. right? They also didn't touch the issue of beheads, and that's sort of a fancy way of saying elected officials ask special interests and others for money to support their favorite charities. And that kind of money can get very large. It can be tens of thousands of dollars. Reformers who were really kind of ticked off by the time the vote finally happened, they sort of felt like approving it almost was worse than not approving it in their mind, because they felt it wasn't going to do the job and it was only like going to disappoint the public.
And my understanding also is that the bill won't even take effect until 2022, which is after the next council race.
Well, it's actually after the next one and a half council races, right? Mm-hmm. So the candidates, they already knew for months, the reformers knew for months that the candidates next year in the March election and any November runoff, this wasn't going to apply to them, right? But then in the last couple of months, they pushed out the timeline even further so it doesn't affect people running in March of 2022. Mm-hmm. And that's like seven incumbents on a 15-member council.
Right.
Now, they may not all run, but if they did all run, they're going to be able to take money from developers, the owners of the development, the applicant for the development project, the board chairman, you know, basically the executives. All that fundraising is going to keep going. And so you can imagine sort of the people who'd wanted more restrictions felt kind of schnookered.
Well, it turns out there's several council members who also agree with the LA Times on this. Mike Bonin was critical of the bill. He said it was time to stop passing, quote, piecemeal crap, which brings us to this idea he and Rue and Carrezza floated, which is a full public financing of local election campaigns. Can you give us the basis of how that might work?
Well, you know, it was extremely broad brushstrokes where they basically said that if a candidate agrees not to take, you know, corporate money, agrees not to take special interest money, agrees not to self-finance, which is to say spend their own money to, you know, large sums. If they agree to raise a significant amount of money, like $5 a pop, sort of like seed money, so to speak, right? If they do all those things, then yes, there would be quote unquote full taxpayer financing. But beyond sort of those broad brushstrokes, how it would work, how much it would cost, all of that stuff would have to be dealt with by the city's policy analysts and by the ethics commission. Now, you should know, by the way, you know, what had happened was on the council floor, there was sort of a lot of agita toward David Rue, who was the backer of the developer donation ban. And I think a goodly portion of that was stemmed from the fact that he actually tried to make the measure on developer donations go into effect earlier, right? Mm. And so you had folks like Mike Bonin, who said that, you know, he was a little irked about that. The funny thing was, you know, this bigger enchilada, the public financing, I mean, it's been kicking around for a couple of years and nothing ever happened with it. And like the council file on it basically died in January. So kind of one of the big questions is, like, how far is this measure going to get this time? You know, they had 3 years to do something and nothing happened.
Do you think it has a chance of passing this time?
I think it's going to be rough sledding for it. I mean, maybe if there's a ballot measure. I don't think council members like giving up their power. And I don't think they like giving up their prerogative. And, you know, just getting this through, I mean, it was pretty watered down, as you now understand. I think that next step, the most likely way I think it would have a shot is if it was for sort of when there's a big crop of new candidates who would come in. So this, for example, like the seven people who are running in 2022, six of those seven, it's their last term. So if there's a big crop of new people, maybe for whom a new system would not be so scary, I could see a possibility of that getting through. But it still would be a big lift.
And, you know, the idea of this is it's a public financing system. Could a wealthy candidate still, though, be able to spend or raise their own money?
Well, I mean, the way it was pitched 3 years ago, it was pitched as a voluntary system. You know, again, there's really no meat on the bones yet to know how this would work. But I would assume that it would have to be. But I haven't seen a report. It's basically an idea that they're resurrecting after, you know, 3 years of no activity.
All right. And there's also, by the way, some concern, I know, that this would just incentivize big money contributors to give to what are called independent expenditure committees. Those are also known as PACs, most people have heard of. After the Supreme Court Citizens United decision, those PACs can take and spend as much money as they want without even revealing who the contributors are. So is it really even possible, as things stand, to control the flow of money into the political system, whatever the council votes?
Well, I mean, they always say political money is like water. It will find channels through which to flow. And I think it's absolutely true. I don't see how they're going to be able to regulate IEs. That's actually the subject of an older Supreme Court ruling, I think from the 70s. I think it's Buckley versus Vallejo. And they haven't been able to touch it. You know, there's talk. Councilman Paul Carrezza wants to take another look. You know, it's kind of hard because on the one hand, I mean, there are places that have put in more restrictions, like places that have done what they call a non-individual ban, which is basically, unless you're a human being, you can't give, right?
Yeah.
Those have so far withstood challenge. So it's possible to take some corporate money out, but obviously, like, there's always a way to fund under the current sort of set of rulings.
Dave Zonizer covers City Hall for the LA Times. Thank you, sir, for putting it all in perspective.
Thank you.
That's it for today's Greater LA. Next time, stories that seem to unfold all around you in three dimensions. It's not virtual reality, it's actual reality, sort of. We'll plunge into the world of escape rooms and immersive theater on tomorrow's Greater LA. We are online at kcrw.com/Greater LA. I'm Rico Galliano. Thanks for listening and for caring about your town. Have a great day living in it.